This is a recording from the Massachusetts Software Council Open Source Summit, which was also the Software Council's Open Source Special Interest Group's kickoff meeting. The meeting was on June 24, 2005. The Massachusetts Software Council established the Open Source Special Interest Group to facilitate a dialogue between professionals who are engaged in efforts around the topic of open source. One purpose of the Open Source Summit was to serve as a basis for further opening the dialogue on this very important topic in the software industry. While it was organized as panel discussions, it was expected that all attendees would actively engage in collaborative discussions with those panel members and each other, and as you'll hear, they did. The event was moderated by me, Dan Bricklin, President, Software Garden, and Bob Zurich, Vice President, Advanced Technology, Essential Software, which is now part of IBM. The event was sponsored through the generosity of Essential Software, and the cost of audio taping was paid for by Novell. Software Garden took care of processing the tapes into audio computer files and uploading them to the internet. This first file consists of about 5 minutes of introduction to the meeting, and then the session on open source licensing with panelists Karen Copenhaver of Black Duck Software and Ira Heffin of the law firm of Goodwin Procter. It runs a little over an hour.
Well, good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Oh, great. This is going to be a fun morning and short afternoon. First of all, welcome. My name is Bob Zurich. I'm had been with Essential Software, now part of IBM, which we were just recently acquired, and really pleased to welcome everybody to what we think is going to be a terrific day. And I apologize for the agenda said 8 o'clock, but we're still on schedule. Believe it or not, as long as I keep my mouth shut and we get things going, we'll land at 8:30 here to get things kicked off. I wanted to make a few initial opening remarks. This has been a vision by a team of people at the Mass Software Council that was assembled by Joyce Plotkin to explore opportunities on how the Mass Software Council can really bring value to its memberships and the community in New England about various high-level topics. Specifically, this effort was about open source, as you can imagine. So they assembled a special interest group, and we began noodling in a room over at Novell, and started whiteboarding, and the next thing you know, we came up with this notion of the Massachusetts Open Software Summit, which is this is what we're celebrating today. And I wanted to acknowledge the members of the organizing committee. So Dan Bricklin, who's here today, and really our primary host and moderator for a lot of the sessions, Joyce Plotkin, who couldn't join us today. She's off, I think, in Alaska someplace, having a lot of fun. Probably a good place to be, especially with the weather forecast, the way it's looking like tomorrow. Paul Cormier. Saw Paul. Where's Paul here? Nope. Okay, from Red Hat. Tom Moran from Black Duck Software. Where's Tom? Getting coffee. And then Dave Patrick, who's also with Novell. So that's the organizing team of the special interest group. I'd also like to, thank Novell for funding part of this program, primarily around supporting us for the costs associated with this. We decided to also charge a very, very minimal fee for non-members, and so to keep it low, we got funding from both Novell and IBM to sponsor the event, so we're pretty excited about that. So thanks to my colleagues at IBM and Novell. Everybody has a copy of the agenda. And did everybody get a copy of Dan's video DVD? Great. How many people haven't gotten it? Okay, good. All right. If you haven't, there'll be some out there. And then everybody have a red ticket? Okay. Who doesn't have a red ticket?
Me.
All right. Well, you're. So that red ticket is a chance to win one of two iPod shuffles that we're going to give away. That's also been donated by Essential IBM. And so I want to make sure you have a chance to win that. We'll do a drawing out of a paper bag kind of thing. So hold on to that number. You have to be present to win. Okay, so what I'll do now is turn it over to my esteemed colleague, Dan Bricklin, and he'll take it from there. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. Now, especially thank you to Bob, because we're in this wonderful place, and we're not in Starbucks meeting, and we can thank Bob for kicking in for that. The way the SIG is going to work is we're going to have a lot of help from the people involved, people sponsoring things and stuff like that. I mean, I kicked off giving out a handout that's supposedly worth more than what you're paying to get in. We're expecting people to be able to give out literature. This is not, I mean, the whole idea of the special interest group is to be a catalyst for things so we can be used for commerce and stuff like that. Don't be overly commercial, only things with value, but it's okay to bring literature to give out and stuff like that. It's okay to sponsor stuff. We are recording today. You should know that because we expect a lot of audience participation, but if what you're going to say you don't want to end up on a recording that is going to be on the internet, preface what you're going to say by saying, if you can remember, please cut this out, because we're going to, I will try if I'm the one who's doing it to cut it out, but we're going to try to put this on, but I would rather that everything be available open. We're going to try to make some of this available as MP3s for people who missed it or who want to hear the stuff again. The people who are here, how many of you are lawyers? Okay, so that's about a third, something like that. How many people here are at software development companies, people who like sell software or things like that? That's about three quarters? Or something like that. No, that doesn't leave very much left. How many are just plain old companies that use software and are here? So we have a smattering of that. Okay, to get an idea, how many are with very small companies, like less than 10 people in the company? So we have about a third of us, or something like that. That's good. And let's see, what other. Oh, yes, okay.
One of the things I forgot to acknowledge is that there's been two people behind the scenes, and I just wanted to make sure it slipped my mind here, is Carol Thompson from IBM helped coordinate with Babson and getting all the logistics squared away, and then Carol Greenfield from Mass Software Console, who was helping with registrations and whatnot, and the rest of the team from Mass Software Console. So thanks, Carol and company.
We're going to need a lot of volunteers to help with this organization. We'll talk about that later this afternoon. Any other questions about splits we would want to have? Would you want to know any others?
I was going to ask when we started, how many people really feel like they know a lot about open source licensing already, or know enough?
How many don't?
Yeah.
How many don't?
That's good. How many really?
Okay, so it's about half and half. Good. Right. Okay, so our first session, as a segue into the first session. The first session will be about open source licensing. And we have two people who will introduce themselves. We have Karen and Ira, who will explain a little bit about their background and why they're here. But we expect a lot of interaction with the audience. Okay. So our first session is open source licensing.
Can everyone hear me back there? Okay, great. So I'm Ira Heffin. I'm an attorney in the intellectual property group at Goodwin Procter. I was in the group of about 85 people from Tester Hurwitz, from the technology practice at Tester Hurwitz, that came over to Goodwin Procter recently. And I focus my practice on patent and trademark prosecution, technology licensing, and I spend a fair amount of time working with clients and helping them use open source appropriately, if they're proprietary software companies, or helping open source companies figure out how to develop their business models and use open source, and develop a business around open source software. So we kind of do a little bit of both of those things. I was doing some of those things at Tester Hurwitz as well, where I worked with Karen, and we worked together advising, advising all sorts of companies from the time that open source wasn't really, much of anything. You didn't hear much about it. And just over time, it's really snowballed to a point where, you know, every time you're thinking about software or looking at a software company and thinking about what's in their product and ask them, well, do you use any open source? The answer is inevitably yes. And I'm sure Karen will talk about this, but I mean, it became, I think, pretty clear to us, over the past several years that open source is not going away. I mean, we were talking, you know, we'll talk a little bit more about this in our slides, but open source is not going away, and it needs to be, I think, thought of, and we'll get more into this, but it needs to be thought about carefully, but at the same time, I think there's just no way that a company can stop or cannot use open source in its day-to-day business. And so that's, I think, what we're going to talk about today is how do you, you know, what are the issues, or, you know, what are some of the issues, especially some of the more interesting issues around that, and, you know, how do you go about thinking about this a little, how do you go about thinking about this?
Yep. I'm Karen Copenhaver. I originally was at IBM a long time ago, 1979 to 1992, and then I was out on the West Coast for a while. I was at an IP firm in Silicon Valley in Arizona, and then I came to Testa. I was at Testa for 10 years, and the remarkable thing is that Ira and I were sitting at a dinner the night that he came, and we started the night that he was starting at the firm, and he mentioned the fact that he had written a case note, right? I have the right term, when he was at Stanford on the GPL. And I said, well, that's interesting, because I'm really interested in that subject, too. We taught a class at the firm, the first, it was like 1996, and everybody said, what did that have to do with anything? I mean, it was, and in 1997, we were at a mergers and acquisitions conference. They wanted me to talk about IP due diligence, and I said, what I want to talk about is open source. And they said, why? And so why would anybody want to talk about that? So we've had a great time talking about this subject for many years and watching it grow. And it's so exciting to be able to have a conference and have everybody show up, because it is a part of the infrastructure. And even when we say every company uses it, it's because almost every company interacts with at least an Apache web server every day that they do business. Everybody who's got a browser. I mean, there's so many pieces of open source that we absolutely rely upon that it really is. It's so funny to me when anybody ever talks about open source as being unreliable. I think, well, the world will shake if we stop using it. Oh, because I'm going to get started, I am at Black Duck Software, which is a company that focuses on being able to manage the use of open source in any enterprise, because this is part of getting rid of the fear, uncertainty, and doubt, is to be able to automate the management and control of licensed materials, which includes open source. And we actually did bring our marketing materials in the back, and I'd be happy to talk to anybody on that subject at any time today. One of the things we always have to make certain when we talk to a group is that when you use the term open source, love the smiles, when you use the term open source, that is actually can be a radioactive term. The free and open source movement wants to concentrate on certain aspects of the freedom in the use of the software, and other people just rely to open source as any software that's available in source code form, which could include something like Microsoft's shared source. And the phrase has to be used carefully unless you explain exactly what you're talking about. And today we're pretty much going to talk about any software that is made widely available in source code form for download, usually but not always without charge. And the reason we're going to talk about that software is because that software is the software that's been coming in the back door at companies. So, you know, normally you have a procurement process that says if a company is going to enter into a contract or a relationship and they're going to spend money, that contract has to go through the CFO or go through your procurement organization or go through some sort of an internal control that reviews the terms that are applicable to the purchase and signs off on it. The reason that open source software has this bad rap about being uncontrolled is that you don't have to pay for it, and therefore when it comes in the door, it doesn't go through those internal control processes unless companies get control of their systems and try to manage it. And this is the reason why there's a lot of open source that has worked itself into code bases, because it was available for download. And since there are a lot of attorneys in the room, I always tell this story, but it's just to level set everybody. Because sometimes I'd look out and I'd see a sea of attorneys, and they're acting like you guys, you developers that put this open source into the source code, like you're drunk and disorderly. You know, oh, well, they're out of control putting all the source code into the into their source tree. But if I ask the lawyers in the room, how many of you would ever start writing a contract with a clean sheet of paper? I mean, how many of you, if you had a contract to write and you had to get it done on time, which developers, believe it or not, have very, very tough time schedules, just like you, and you had to bring it in at cost, would you rewrite every piece of boilerplate in the contract? And if I had a tool that could recreate every contract you've ever read and scan every contract you ever wrote, how many clauses would I find that were were copied from Microsoft contracts? And what would your defense be? Let me give you your defense. Your defense would be, I didn't notice the copyright notice. Which Microsoft has. I'm not sure they still do, but for a long time, all of their contracts were copyrighted. And if you're an attorney, you know they're copyrighted anyway, right? And then you'd say, no, it's purely functional. You know, that little piece of code, that export clause, no expression in there, purely functional. Didn't get away with that one, you'd go to de minimis. De minimis. Quantitatively, it's, but you copied it for a purpose. And you know why you copied it? You copied it because it was peer-reviewed. You copied it because it's something that's been out there and many, many eyeballs have looked at it and it's passed the test of time.
And it came from your old firm?
And so the comment was, it makes everybody laugh, he said. You can never repeat a joke very well, but the comment was, and it came from your old firm. It came from your old firm. That's exactly why developers want to use this the code. I mean, the first time, and maybe this really changed the way I felt about open source, the very first question that I ever got about anything under the GPL was about a math library. And, you know, my reaction, I read the GPL, thought, this is crazy. You know, this was very early. And I said, don't use it. You know, that's like weird. And the developer came back and said, this library is so valuable because everybody in, all these different universities use this library. I could not recreate this library if I tried. Even if I wrote it, I wouldn't have the confidence in it. I need this library. And it really put a different, sort of a different spin on, on my approach to the GPL because I realized that if there's code that is really valuable, and it is used by everybody in the world, and everybody benefits from that, it ought to be available. So what we're talking about today is we're referring to software that's made widely available in source code form. That software is made available under many, many, many different licenses. The GPL is by far the most popular, but it is not the only license. We've got over 500 open source licenses in a database, and they vary. Some are very different, some are very similar, but there are many, many different licenses. Some have this reciprocal sharing or enforced sharing obligation, which says you can use my code as long as the code that is created with my code, either as a derivative work or in a file, there are different definitions, as long as that code is also made available in source code form. And those are generally the licenses that make the lawyers nervous. But there are also many other licenses that have different obligations, that have very few obligations. There's different licenses. And it's also distributed in many different ways, in many different business models. And this is what makes it interesting. But I can't, you can't even start talking about open source without saying that I'm a little sad that we started this off with a discussion about law and about licenses. Because when I go to conferences, I hear everybody talking about the legal issues. The most interesting, the most compelling, the most revolutionary thing about open source is not the license. The most revolutionary thing about open source is the collaborative development model. That's what blows my mind, is how companies have gone in such a short period of time from thinking that the best thing that they could do was to work in a tower and work alone and protect it, and how people in one generation have gone and completely turned that around and said, there are pieces of my business that I ought to be developing in community. That idea will not only revolutionize the software industry, it'll revolutionize every industry on earth, the pharmaceutical industry, every industry. And the speed with which that change took over is breathtaking. The legal issues, the licenses, make some of that possible, and therefore they're interesting. But if you walk out of this thinking that what's really different about open source is the licensing model, you miss the fun part. You miss the fun part. All right.
So when we think about software generally, whenever we're looking at a software license agreement, there's a couple of risks that we think about, right? And so these are the same risks that we think about with open source. They just get dealt with a little bit differently in open source licenses, right? The biggest risk to a software company or any company about a software product that they're using is it going to do what they want? And is it going to do what they want over the long term? What happens if there's bugs? What happens, if there's a new version of the operating system that comes out and it's no longer compatible? Is it going to be supported? Right? That's the main question that a company that's taking in some software is really thinking about. Is it going to work? Is it going to do what I want? Right? The next question is really, I'm putting here as license compliance, but is, what do I have to do to get this software that's going to work for me? In the commercial sense, it's what do I have to pay? What are the other terms of that license that I'm going to have to follow in order to get to use this software? And is that okay with me? Right? And for a proprietary license, you're thinking about things, like I said, about what's the license fee, what are the support fees, what are the other terms that what's the restrictions on how I can use it, and is that going to be okay for the way that I want to use it? And on the open source side, you're thinking about some of those things, and you're also thinking about, like Karen mentioned, the enforced sharing, the reciprocity provision that's in some open source licenses, also called copyleft. But you're thinking about the notices that might be required, especially if you're a software distributor or software vendor and you're including open source in your product. You're thinking about, what am I going to have to think about in terms of what notices I need to put where? Definitely not an insurmountable problem by any means, but if companies that are using a lot of open source need to remember that they're going to put some resources towards that problem. And then, is there any changes to my end user license agreement? Again, if you're a software vendor who's using open source, how does this change the way that I then relate to my customer, the fact that I have open source in my product? And then the third thing, I think the big issue, obviously a software license agreement, there's lots of issues, but the third issue that's worth highlighting is third-party IP claims. What happens if the software that I get has some problem that's not a technical problem, but is an IP problem, right? And then, in the typical commercial scenario, you're looking again to your contract to see what the vendor is going to provide you. And in the open source context, depending on who you're getting the software from, you might be doing the same thing because there might be a support or indemnification contract that comes with it. But if it's something that's over, if it's software you're just downloading over the internet and you're not getting it from a vendor who's going to provide that support, then you're thinking about, is the community going to be able to deal with that problem in a way that makes sense for me? Right? It becomes a very specific question about, is this software and the way I'm going to use it, and the risks that come with that, understanding that there's a community of people and understanding, you need to understand, I think, what that community, how big it is and how likely they are to react and kind of take that into account. How is that going to help me react if there is an IP problem? Right, so you kind of take that all into account. It's a similar analysis on the proprietary software side. You do some of that same analysis in thinking about, I got an indemnification from this company, but what's that worth? Maybe it's limited to a small amount and that's not really helpful to me because it's limited, say, to the price of the contract. And if I really have to defend an IP suit, it's going to be much more than the price of the contract. Or it may be that you have a big indemnification, but the company might not be able to stand up for it anyway. Right? So it's that same calculus that you're doing, you know, both on the open source side and the proprietary side. It's just different pieces that you take into account. Did you have a...
Oh, wait, question?
Oh, sorry.
Yeah?
You kind of like touched on it after I raised my hand.
Okay.
I was just pointing out that on the third bullet, the third-party IP claims, you're defending an allegation. I mean, just as patent law is the sport of kings for a reason, the SCO issue is turning IP allegations into the sport of kings. And I just wanted to make sure that was emphasized.
Yeah.
I'm Marty Connor. I'm the project leader for the Etherboot project.
And it's absolutely true.
I'm Franklin Davis from Nokia. Three of us here work on open source browser at Nokia. Two of the issues we've come up against that I wonder if you might touch on are if you have your own IPR, which you are willing to contribute to the open source body, what protections do you maintain going forward? What we've come to the conclusion is that you're giving it away to anyone to use in the open source context, but a commercial proprietary competitor cannot take that code into their proprietary product, so you still are protected to some degree. So if you have any discussion about whether that's true or not, that would be interesting. And the other question is probably the most common one, how do you build protected code around a piece of open code? We're using LGPL code, so It should be possible, but that's always the big question from our customers who are going to take this code from us. You know, do we have to give away everything we do? And how do you answer that question?
Do you want us to answer that one first?
Should we talk about that one first, Dan?
I'll these up for a bit, but that's
okay.
All right, you can bunch them up.
Okay.
I'd like to deal specifically. I'm Jack Messman with Novell. I'd like to deal with the scope problem in particular. 1973, Novell bought from AT&T Unix Systems Laboratories. In about 1975-76, we sold SCO the right to use those copyrights and patents to develop a business around Unix. We did not sell them the copyrights and the patents. We still own them. They're suing us on whether or not we own the copyrights. I don't know why they wouldn't sue us on whether we own the copyrights and the patents, but we own them both. So
that's only one of many things about that suit
so
that makes no sense.
That's the first issue. The second issue is, as part of that, as belt and suspenders, our lawyers did a good job. We got a license back on our own technology to use Unix with our customers. So even if they prevail on the issue of whether or not we sold them the copyrights and the patents, we have a license to use Unix in the Linux distributions that we sell. So if you want to avoid the SCO problem, this is a commercial. If you want to avoid the SCO problem and make the issue of Unix in Linux go away, use SUSE Linux.
Okay. No, thanks. I mean, that's great. I mean, I do want to say that what we have there as the SCO problem, I was really referring to was not trying to say that there is a real SCO problem, but it's more the problem of a company that participates in the open source community, you know, has code that's out there that's freely flowing, and then decides that they're going to turn on that community and say, my IP's in that stuff, and now I want $600 a server or whatever it is, right? That's the problem. The problem is some third party that comes in and says, my IP's in that open source, and what happens then?
But we're seeing the fact that we have the head of a large company that came in, the fact that you said community matters because the community consists often of a lot of large companies with large resources which can come together.
No, absolutely. That's right.
Yeah, my reaction to SCO is really to talk about the good things that came from SCO because that's my want. And so when you talk about the SCO problem, it really began a lot of discipline that wouldn't have begun maybe so soon if that suit, which turned out to have had a lot of very odd elements to it. But even the way they prosecuted it by writing all those letters to the audit committees and public companies, I mean, it got everybody's attention. And I think there are a number of very positive things that will come from that. I mean, the community is thinking a lot about pedigree in a way that they never would have been able to, you know, to get a hold of if they hadn't had that claim and a claim of that magnitude. And, you know, and here's a claim, you know, IBM stepped up to the plate, Novell stepped up to the plate, you know, Red Hat stepped up to the plate, lots of people stepped up to the plate to really show how those cases can be, you know, will be defended when they're brought. Another thing that happened, which was really interesting, is that the software industry in general did not have any IP indemnities. I mean, most software licenses came with absolutely no infringement indemnity. And, you know, all of a sudden, it was like when your cars began, you know, I think it was Ford that came out with the 100,000-mile powertrain warranty. And, you know, there before that, cars had no warranties. All of a sudden, you couldn't buy a car without a 100,000-mile warranty. Well, you know, it's the same thing in the software industry. I'm seeing a lot of companies that are starting to give indemnities that, you know, that they never would have before. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, I'm not going to comment on, but it certainly is a huge change in the software industry. And in terms of, I mean, I think the most important thing to focus on in terms of third-party IP claims is that, you know, that when people talk about open source, they often talk about the patent problem, as though the patent problem is a problem that relates to open source in a way that's different, unique, and more troubling than it is for the proprietary software industry. And that's just not true. I think in this community response will really put the open source projects in a better position than proprietary projects when patent claims are raised. So, you know, to talk about open source as having more IP problems, at least on the patent side, I think isn't accurate. I think we're going to see a whole different approach to patent litigation on the open source side, because we're not going to tolerate trolls. We'll have the wherewithal not to tolerate patent trolls that go and, you know, settle up a bunch of claims, get a war chest, have a bunch of licenses, and then be able to turn on somebody who's going to be able to pay damages. And I do want to get back to your question, and then we can.
Hi, Gordon Half with Illuminata. Actually, on that particular topic, I wondered if you could maybe comment briefly about the patent piece provisions that are going into a lot of the newer open source licenses, like Cuddle, for example. You know, is that something that's important, or is it sort of a red herring?
I think it is important, and when we get on, we're going to talk a little bit about what's going to be in GPL3, and I think the interesting discussion is whether those kinds of provisions will be incorporated in the next round of the GPL. But what he's talking about is a patent termination provision, which is one of a number of different methodologies that the open source community is using to create this patent commons. I mean, many of the companies in this room have been announcing programs where they're going to make parts of their patent portfolio available to help defend the open source community. That's a huge, huge step towards, you know, defending the community against patent claims. But this idea of a patent termination provision, and I think they're still being refined, but the basic concept is, if I put intellectual property, and it's most easy to understand in terms of a large company with a patent portfolio, but if I put intellectual property into the community and allow you to benefit from it and allow you to use it, and then after you have the things of mine that you want, you turn around and sue me, I want to put all that intellectual property back on the table in the litigation so that we're really evening up on both sides. And that means that my licenses to you are going to end. They're going to terminate. Your license will terminate, and we'll look at the intellectual property of mine that you're using, and we'll look at the claims you've made against me all at the same time. I'm not going to stand here having already licensed you to the things you want and have to defend a claim by you. And that's the way a patent termination provision works. There are huge questions about the appropriate breadth of the termination. So in some cases, the breadth can be very, very broad. It can say, if you're using my software and you sue me for practically anything, your license ends in toto, all the way down to, I'm going to put this piece into the community. If a patent that's practiced on that particular thing becomes an issue, then I'm going to have very specific termination provisions that apply to you. That question of how broad that ought to be is still, I think, open.
Andy Updegrove, Gesmer Updegrove. Just a quick comment that that provision has actually been around for decades in the standards community. And one of the big examples of convergence that's going on right now is the standards world and the open source world are all of a sudden coming together. And there's a lot of misunderstanding on both sides because there's one set of methodologies in the standards community, one set of methodologies in the open source community. They're starting to get acquainted with, there was recently a letter that probably a lot of you have seen from 29 open source advocates to one of my clients, Oasis, saying, you can't have that policy anymore because we don't want you to. And please, everyone, boycott Oasis because we don't like their policy. All those things have to get worked out. But one of the things that's kind of interesting is the provision you note is something that's been around for a long time in the standards community, and now the open source community is looking at it and saying, see, that might be something we want to use as well. But the last comment is there's a huge amount of confusion now in the community because people are using open source and open standards in a muddled way without really understanding what either of them is and how they fit together.
Yeah, no, I think I would agree with that. And I think actually Dan has a piece on his blog on that, right?
Yeah, I've written stuff about the confusion between the word open source and the word open standards. I mean, if you talk to regular people, they don't know the difference. They just hear the word open, and they think it's the same thing. And they know in open standards, they're draconian things where you can lose your patents. Being able to, because you didn't disclose something, because you made some honest mistake, you could actually lose the ability to assert certain patents is the way certain open standards committees work. And that's happened. That has actually happened with Dell, I believe. It didn't happen Rambus, but it almost happened. And that, but then people think that and they think, oh, an open source, it's an open, I could lose my stuff too the same way. And when people say I'm doing open standards, they think they're doing open source, but it could be Microsoft uses open standards. And there's open source that doesn't use open standards because there's standards committees and stuff. Be very careful about being that when you say open standards, people know what you're talking about. Open source, you know what they're talking about. But we got to get back to...
Because we're on slide two. We should probably... Do you want to address the Nokia questions first? I
think yes. We should probably do that. Although we're going to talk about some of those as we go through. So I wrote them down. Maybe we'll come back
at the
end. Is
that okay? We'll make sure we'll circle up at the end, though, if we haven't. Okay.
So we had a slide here on just first principles, which says, you know, the open source is clearly here to stay. We felt like we had to go over those legal points first. What we want to move on to is a couple of issues that people don't talk about as much, because many of you have been to open source conferences. You've seen the same six bullets about the GPL so many times you can't stand it anymore. We wanted to really move into some issues that are currently being discussed. And I guess I skipped all the way to this one, but this is interesting. This is talking about what we're going to do with GPL 3.0. And Evan Moglen, who is a very important person in the open source world, particularly the free and open source world. He is a professor at Columbia Law School, a copyright expert, and he represents the Free Software Foundation and has worked with Richard Stallman really from the very beginning. And he is trying to explain, when we look at moving the GPL from 2.0 to 3.0, you have to understand that the GPL plays four very important roles in the community. And number one, it's a copyright license, which means it's not an express patent license, but it's a copyright license. It's a code of conduct. It is a constitution of the free software movement. And it's a vehicle to express the ideas of Richard Matthew Stallman. And he makes that point very clear, I think, because although this is a community, that the GPL is something very, very important to Richard. And the way to move forward with GPL 3 is to make it very clear that Richard's going to continue to play a role. Because we really do need to move to GPL 3.0, at least to get people, we need to make progress because we've been talking about it for so long that it creates a certain amount of uncertainty and fear in what's going to happen with 3.0. And Evan's trying to take a position, I think, that says we actually are going to manage this through. And one of the things that I'm reassuring, everybody who's been relying on this Free Software Foundation to continue to promote Richard's ideas, I'm telling you, we're not changing course. source. The fact that there now is are big players very active in the use of GPL software, IBM, Novell, and others, is not going to change the GPL 3.0 into a commercial agreement. It's going to continue to be the constitution of the free software movement, and it's going to continue to express the ideas of Richard Matthew Stallman. 2.2, and you want to jump in here?
Yeah, I was just going to say, so in thinking about version 3.0 of the GPL, the Free Software Foundation is talking about that they're trying to take a license that really has done pretty well over, more than 20 years, or almost 20, I'm not doing the math, I had 91, right, so I guess 14, 15, thank you, yeah. I am an engineer, really. Okay, so about 14 years, and they've been talking, they've really been trying, actually, over the past couple of years to try and figure out what to do. And a big problem that they have is that there are so many different interested parties in this license. I mean, when you think about, when I think about any time you just have two parties, and my client and another company, and they've decided that they want to change their relationship a little bit, and we're going to go back and amend the agreement that they have already, that they've been working on, say, for 5 years or 2 years, let alone 14, right? Then there's a lot of work that goes into that, and there's just the two interested parties. Right here, all the people that are interested in this is, well, everybody in this room, right, and probably everybody else in the software industry in some way, and and that includes the people from the Free Software Foundation who are very interested in the idea of copyleft and free software, to the people who just are trying to run businesses and are happy to have the collaboration that comes with free software, to the people who have been using the free software under a certain set of known obligations, and if those change, that's going to really change, it could change the way that they do their whole business, to proprietary vendors who don't want to touch open source at all, but maybe they would if there was some changes to the GPL. So there's a huge range of people who all have some interest in this license, and somehow they're struggling to do to come up with changes. The kinds of changes they're talking about are, first of all, worldwide application, right? So they have this problem also that this is not only in the United States, where contract law is state law, so there's 50 different contract laws that are pretty much the same but have some differences, but worldwide, right? So there's lots of countries that have a lot of different contract rules, and that same license has been working pretty successfully all over the world, but still has some concerns. And then they also want to do some changes for clarification, right? And that's where really I think gets interesting, because that's where the changes are going to affect one side or the other.
And part of what we're talking about is really that the industry has changed so much, and it is amazing that the license has stood up so well. The concept of static and dynamic linking that gives us so much problems, so many problems, really is linked very much to Unix. And you can go to Dan's website. He's got lots of things that you've talked about in terms of, he has a podcast about it. There's the concept of what the copyrighted work is, and we could spend all day. We've talked about what is really derived. What's this concept of a derivative work, which is under copyright law? And for those points, it's important to remember that when they were putting the GPL together in the first place, it was a very different time in terms of intellectual property licensing. And there were great concerns about writing a license that went beyond your intellectual property rights, that extended controls on things that you actually didn't own. And it's always been the case that the GPL has gone as far as copyright will permit you to go, but not any farther. And so the use of copyright terms in the GPL was very specific to get that we want to assert as much power as we possibly can with the copyrights that we hold in this code, but we don't want to go any farther and raise any issues or concerns about misusing those copyrights by asserting controls over things that are outside of our rights. And that's why words like derivative work were used, because those are terms that are in the Copyright Act. The problem is that there is almost no case law relating to derivative works of source code. There are cases relating to derivative works of software that really address visual elements, that address GUIs and address things like that. But in terms of a derivative work of source code, there is almost no guidance in the courts at all. And one of the things that I think you're going to see a lot of in the next few years is that the legal community is going to begin developing more commentary on this subject. And there are many people who are working to have, you know, have that happen. In a variety of different forum. It's hard because we really don't want to litigate those issues. You know, big cases that make that make groundbreaking decisions that make things clear are very expensive for whoever has to fight them. And it often is not fair who has to fight them. I mean, if you remember, the VCR was defended by Betamax, not by VHS. That's who paid the bill.
You just said, we do not want to litigate them. Who is we, General Counsel?
Who's this? We seem to have IBM and SCO funded by Microsoft and whoever else they can get to buy a Unix license litigating their brains out. Lawyers are getting fabulously wealthy. As a matter of fact, I'm thinking a law degree might not be a bad idea. So who exactly might we be?
I was speaking there of the community.
Oh, the community!
The community. And yes, I am not a litigator. I'm sure actually there are many people who would love to litigate these things. But the other thing is, and here I'm very serious. The problem is, it will take 20 years. I mean, think about this. The first
13 already?
That's right. Well, you think about when the first shrink wrap came out. How long did it take us to get any real guidance on shrink wraps? 20 years? I mean, the first shrink wraps were written in the early 80s, you know, and there's been confusion for years about those kinds of agreements. And we're now getting all this case law that's very consistent. But it takes 20 years. It takes 20 years. We don't want to wait 20 years and have that uncertainty continue to affect the industry for that long, even if we did get a lot of lawyers who actually did want to litigate.
And you think you can do it in less than 20 years?
No, I think, what I'm thinking is that what finally solved the shrink wrap case, I mean, Pro CD, whether you like or don't like that decision, the judge came out and said, regardless of what you want to argue, this is what the industry actually does. And one of the problems that we've had is that we don't have a lot of people writing about what derivative works of source code are. And the reason is that the fact situations are too complicated. People in firms don't want to take positions that could be interpreted against their clients. There's just very little that's been written about it. And we need to begin to have more discussions and conferences and symposium where that guidance, that community consensus really is formed. And you see that in these discussion groups. And as it begins to solidify, when that case comes up, there will be a lot of guidance for the judge. Whereas if you get a case and there is no guidance, it goes off on the side. So,
Can I just tie that, what you were just saying about the derivative works, into the second question that the folks from Nokia asked, which is, they're interested in, well, okay, so we have this LGPL code, and how do we figure out whether, you know, someone can use it, and how do you use it, and that's tied into that same language. I mean, I think, and Karen really just gave the answer there, which is, you know, really is a case-by-case sort of analysis of that code. I mean, it's not, you know, you'd like to say, okay, if you do this, you're all set, right? But it's really going to be, because of the language, because of where it is, an analysis of, you know, here's the open source product, here's your product, are you using it in a way where this is derived from that, or are you using it in a way that seems consistent with, you know, what the license says, and then also thinking about, you know, as sort of general risk analysis, well, what, you know, whose software is it, you know, what are they thinking, you know, and then from more of a risk analysis, you know, how likely is this, are they going to think that this is a problem? I mean, and those are the kinds of things you do, you know, with every kind of contract. I mean, and it's a very similar analysis, except you're sort of dealing with the community on the other side in terms of open source license. Mm-hmm.
So this is a guidance in a way to some of the developers that you can do what Linus did, what Larry Wall did with Perl, mm-hmm. where they put some extra things saying, here is how I am interpreting derivative work, specifically because it is really based on it's OS specific, it's application specific to some extent if you listen to what the Free Software Foundation said. And that's what some of them have done. Linus has said, here's some things, he has a separate thing. You'll see it in the video. I give copies, I show that actual stuff. Larry Wall says, even though the GPL normally doesn't allow you to do this, I am allowing you to do it because that's how I'm interpreting it here. Mm-hmm. So you can do some clarity, at least for your own code.
Mm-hmm. Yep, go ahead. Go. You want to go back? And that's right. One of the questions that comes up is, you know, whose interpretation of the GPL controls? Go ahead.
Yeah, Will Tabor, I'm with Rational Software, IBM. But one of the things that Linus said was that, for instance, you could have a kernel module, and that's okay, even though it's not really under the terms of the GPL. But my impression is that, in fact, the Linux kernel development community is backing away from that and is coming out more and more strongly that you can't have binary-only kernel modules.
Paul Zoffice from First Technology. On the earlier slide, you had the very interesting fourth or fifth bullet that identified deployment. And before you hasten to the next slide, since deployment occurs outside of the development process and outside of the firm and is kind of a world view versus everything we've talked about here, which is kind of a constricted inside the firm view. Can you comment a little bit about deployment and where that might go?
Yeah, we can both talk about that. When we talk about deployment, the issue has always been distribution. I mean, the GPL has one very interesting area where it says if you're using things internally and you're not distributing them, that those are not subject to the enforced sharing obligations. It also says, which many people misunderstand, that if you are subject to the enforced sharing obligations, you only have to deliver the source code to the person to whom you deliver the object code. There's no obligation under the GPL to put your source code on the web and make it available to the world. But if you're only using it internally and you don't deliver the object code to anyone, then you're not subject to the enforced sharing obligations. As the world moves towards web services and more of the browser-based applications where you're allowing somebody to use your software without actually taking it and distributing it to anyone, there are a lot of questions as to whether that exception is too broad and whether it ought to be altered. And Evan would say that there's probably not one solution to that question. There are probably several solutions to that question that will need to be discussed as to when, if you have software which you're allowing people to use but not distribute, when the enforced sharing obligations will apply to that, you know, to that software. And I think when we were talking about deployment, because we're hearing that word a lot, it's really talking about basing licensing obligations on use as opposed to on distribution. Eunice.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And that's just one of the things that's on the table. Some of the open source licenses that are out there do that right now. They hook the source code distribution obligation on deployment. And I think there's some question, in the thinking about GPL 3.0 about would they try and do that and put some provisions in there. And that would change the bargain, and companies who right now are users, would feel that I think was a problem. I mean, I think it's going to be very hard for them to do that. Let me just say that. I mean, I think that, even though there's, some people in the, who are out there who are saying, well, yeah, we really should have this because that's fair. There's other people, in terms of people sort of feeling like they have a safe harbor on the distribution because they're just using it internally. Using it internally, but outside facing, that would be, that could end up being a problem for them. So yeah, so it's on the table.
And the last point on the chart, which is one that Evan spends a lot of time talking about, is trusted computing, which would mean that there would be a restriction on the access to the source code if you were in certain environments where you were trying to protect against protect against use by unauthorized parties.
Doug Napoleone from ScanSoft. When it comes to extending the GPL or any software license to include use of non-distributed software, it affects more industries than just the software industry itself. The biggest, the easiest example for me would be back-end transcription services, which many lawyers and the healthcare industry uses extensively. And many of those solutions do use open source software at those back offices. So when you cut that out, all of a sudden that will affect probably every industry currently that's out there.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And we'll go through these very quickly because we only have a few minutes left. But I love the fact that everybody joined in. This is what we wanted to have happen. So once you start talking about taking the GPL from 2.0 to 3.0, and you start talking about making these kinds of changes that could affect this industry and the Googles and the eBays and others of the world that are operating in those kinds of environments, you begin to start asking questions about, whose interpretation of the contract matters. I mean, can Linus actually come out with a pronouncement and say, this is what I think the GPL means, and have that control? Or does it only control the software that, that he releases? Is, the reality is that a contract is really a meeting of the minds, but when there's no negotiation, when the contract's just putting out there, how much is there an actual meeting of the minds? But generally, you would say if Linus is putting the contract on his software, that what he meant is really important, and that he could mean something different. Other people absolutely reject that interpretation. And we could talk about these for a while, but how to manage compliance. Well, this is the last subject, which, of course, is the one near and dear to my heart, is managing compliance. Because this is where, when companies begin to think about the fact that you're going to have, and this is your question, that you're going to have both proprietary software and open source software even close to each other, that's what makes people nervous. That's, that's when all the talks about deadly disease start. It's a cancer, it's a virus, and it's all this horrible stuff. And I think what I want to make clear is that there are many, many ways to get a hold of this issue and to manage compliance, and you're going to see enormous growth in this area. Again, a part of it comes from the disciplines that arose after the SCO suit. Now that people are focusing on it and realizing that it's important, there are technologies like Black Duck and others, I'll do my ad, that help you manage this and control where your code's coming from and to know what those obligations are. And as we move into an environment where more people are developing code, both proprietary and open source, in a modular manner, which I think is it's finally here. We've talked about object-oriented programming, for years, but I think we're really into a place where we're going to be reusing components. It's not going to be five parts. It's not going to be, three parts or six parts. You're going to have programs that are made up of 50 different contributions. And not only do you need to know what those 50 different contributions and obligations are for your initial use, but you're going to want to be able to take that product off the shelf and to know what those obligations are so that you can reuse your own assets. And this will be a natural process which will take a lot of the fear out of using open source out of the system. And your ideal process, I like to say this because people think that these things arise out of concern that what you want to do is exclude open source. These processes are really all about enabling companies to go from an environment where the management team is sort of feeling like, just say no, we don't want to go there, this is too complicated, and really enabling companies to embrace open source and to say, if we're going to be the most competitive software company on earth, which all of us, is part of the goal of all commercial companies, then we need to be able to exploit these resources more efficiently and better than our competition. And that means that we can't forego opportunities just because they're scary and just because it's difficult to manage. We need to embrace them. That doesn't mean that you go willy-nilly and begin copying anything on the web. As I think Ira was trying to point out earlier, it's very important to think about the source of the open source. To participate in a broad community that is dependent upon something like Apache or Linux is a very different risk proposition than taking something off of a website that, you know, that there is no user community for, where you really don't have a reason to think that they've had any control over the pedigree of the code. The source of the source is very important. I work with companies all over the country that are using open source, and you'd be surprised how many companies actually go back to the original author and negotiate an agreement for code that they have found on the web that is valuable in order to get some assurance that they understand where it came from and to understand what their rights are.
How many people here have gone to the author and negotiated something that wasn't expected and that wasn't just a normal deal? We have 4 or 5 people who are saying that. Fine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it really happens. It surprised me how often. It's good. It's very valuable code. Just because it's on the web doesn't mean it's good or it's bad. You have to do the same kind of procurement process you would do with any other company or acquisition to determine how you feel about it. The other thing, and I guess this is a good thing to close on, and you can comment on it. For the legal counsel in the room, we need to be talking to the developers more often and better. What I see from years ago is that that the developers would be working on something, they'd find something that they wanted to use. They'd be told that they had to go review it with legal counsel. The developer would say, "Oh, geez, I got to make that appointment." They'd trek over across town. They'd talk to the lawyer. The lawyer would say, "I need this, 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 this," and the developer would come back. The developer would say, "Oh God, I got to get this, 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 and this," and then it would go off a couple of days, and then you'd sort of, and then 2 weeks later you go back and see the lawyer. The lawyer would say, "Oh, that's really interesting. Let's get this and this because this would really be interesting," and you go back, and meanwhile the stuff's baked into the product. Everybody's building on top of it. You're getting the product QA'd. Everything's getting lined up. And then you get, to the very end, and there's some sort of a discussion, and they say to the lawyer, "Well, can you tell me absolutely that that we're never, ever going to have a problem with this code?" And the lawyer has to say, "Well, I can't tell you that. I mean, I can't tell you that nobody's ever going to make a claim. I can tell you that this is, that I feel good about this, but I can't tell you nobody's, oh, then let's not use it." But that happens, that happens like once a year, once every 6 months. And the lawyer doesn't feel all that bad about saying no, because it doesn't happen all that often. And it's like, well, we had this one thing, we couldn't use it. What needs to happen is that the lawyers and the developers need to be talking like every other day. And as the lawyers begin to understand that each of these issues and each of these decisions has an impact on cost, it has an impact on development time, it has an impact on quality, it has an impact on interoperability, as you begin to understand that these decisions have tremendous impact on your business, and you become more comfortable in the conversations with the developers, we will be giving very different advice. Because we will not be able to say this stuff is absolutely, we know where it came from and it's totally safe. But there's no business on earth that can operate in that environment either.
Yeah, I mean, I would just make one comment is that, a lot of times when I work with developers, I hear, a comment that's something like, "How come I have to be a lawyer to write software?" It's, ugh. But the reality of that, why do the developers have to think about licensing maybe in a way that they hadn't before? I mean, it just comes because it's really a new world, right? The way that software is getting developed is new. There's, so much use of third-party code. There's so much collaboration. There's so much sort of community development of some software and people making use of that to build into their products to make these enormous solutions, right? I mean, because of that change, right, which is great because, right, the code reuse, right, that's like the nirvana, right, of software development, right, is the reuse and all those benefits. So, of course, coming with that is going to be some thinking about, well, I have this code, well, what do I need to do to use it, and what are the licensing terms that apply? I mean, just when you think about it that way, I think it's pretty natural.
And I have lots to say on that, but it's on the table. Yeah.
I'm Gus Bjorklund from Progress Software. I just want to comment on how developers should work with lawyers. Having learned how to do it with the lawyers at Progress, what works really well is to go to the lawyer and say, "Help me solve this problem." if you go through the process you just described, Karen, yes, it takes weeks and months and gets more and more complicated, but if you explain to the lawyers what problem you want solved and what needs to be accomplished, it works a whole lot better. And, you know, our lawyers are perfectly willing to work with developers to solve problems.
It's great.
And I'm sure
I
others
I know your
are.
Lawyers, and they're wonderful.
This is really cool, by the way. It's so refreshing to hear people talk about open source from a legal context like this. Last night, the Supreme Court, by a 5-4 decision, decided that it was the state's responsibility to decide when private property may be taken for commercial purposes. And the reason I bring that up, and by the way, if you get a chance, Sandra Day O'Connor wrote a really excellent dissenting opinion on that. So do read that. But what I really wanted to say was, all you really are accomplishing, as far as I can tell, is due diligence. When the claims come, and they will, Mr. Novell, when the fecal matter hits the fan, what's going to happen is you're going to bring in your reams of documentation. But the dirty trick was played. The developer came in, had three cans of Red Bull, put in some IP, knowingly or unknowingly. And what you can say is, we did due diligence. We told them to use this piece of software, and maybe the judge will let you off. But, I mean, isn't that, at the point of litigation, what it really comes down to?
Well, maybe before. Oh, yeah, maybe before, but there are technologies that'll be able to tell you that. I mean, I'll tell you very quickly a story. A guy came in, he was talking to me about, because our code can tell you when there's open source copied into your source tree, and he said, I had two really bad days recently. One was the day that I had to fire the best programmer I'd ever hired, and he said that, you know, it was a young kid, wasn't raised in America, came to a great school, the best programmer I'd ever hired. He came in, he was, everybody loved working with him. At some point, it occurred to us that it was not humanly possible to write as much code as he had written. And we began to look at what he had written, and he was brilliant. He was cutting and pasting from all kinds of great code on the internet. He said it was a really bad day. He had been sent to the training. The training said we don't do that. He said, I couldn't believe that you really meant that. Because why would you not reuse that? Just didn't make any sense. He didn't have any options. He had to terminate the guy. He said, the next day that I had that was really bad was a couple days later when it occurred to me that he had worked for us for 9 months, and I really didn't have a good idea what he had contributed to, because he was new, he was working on a bunch of different projects and contributing all over the place. I think, you know, the idea that you're not able to control that, you can control it now. So I think we're.
I didn't say you couldn't control it. I said that all you're doing is providing due diligence when the claims come.
Yeah.
You are not controlling it.
Yes. So yes.
In the way the Software Council likes to run is to try to be on time, because we made a deal with you about when we're going to start and end.
And we
have a lot more to cover too. So we're going to end on that note. In fact, it's a good segue because Karen works for a company that. Which I have done some work with, disclaimer, that automatically looks for and helps that. And that brings up the fact that there are many other types of companies that are in the ecosystem of open source. And in the next session, we're going to be talking about different ways of being businesses in the world of open source, different parts of the ecosystem. But until then, we're going to have a break, but we're going to start promptly whatever it says, 9:45. We're going to start promptly. So talk to each other and be back here, sitting here at 9:45.